You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
There are scientists and there are great scientists. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy has studied life in Brazil's Amazon since 1965. He's advised the World Bank, the United Nations, and more. Lovejoy heads the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. He started the term biodiversity in science. You are about to hear his latest speech, a keynote introducing 2010 as the UNESCO Year of Biodiversity. It was recorded in Paris January 25th by independent environmental journalist Stephen Leahy and sent that night to Radio EcoShock. Here is Thomas Lovejoy with a plea for the remains of life as the climate shifts.
We are at the start of the sixth major extinction of life on Earth. And the question before humanity is, how far will that be allowed to proceed? I'll talk a little bit at the outset on three points. One on the exploration of life on Earth. Second, on life as the living library for the life sciences, and a little bit on economics. And then I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about climate change, its implications for biological diversity, and how biological diversity has major implications for climate change itself, and indeed could transform, indeed revolutionize how we address climate change. So, exploring life on Earth, a vastly unfinished job, a grand adventure intellectually and otherwise, one that on the largest scale that it deserves has never quite caught fire, but has really important elements accomplished, like the census of marine life, which we will celebrate and learn about this evening. Suffice it to say, in the course of my own lifetime, the tree of life has changed from being a tree to this low-lying, spreading bush with the higher, so-called higher organisms of plants, animals, and fungi, now three terminal twigs on the upper right, and all the rest of it made up of microorganisms with strange metabolisms and strange appetites deriving from the earliest conditions of life on Earth. Completing the job of exploring biodiversity and giving us the fundamental information of what there is and where it is, so fundamental to managing it wisely, is in fact within our grasp. And Stuart Pym and colleagues have a paper submitted to the PNAS at the moment looking at this for well-known groups such as flowering plants, and this is an illustration of how it comes out with one family, estimating maybe 15% of the species of the Rubiaceae still to be described. And the important point as we think about the future of biodiversity is that most of those will be species with small ranges and probably from hotspot areas. So probably our estimate of the percentage of flowering plants which are endangered needs to be essentially raised to something like 30%. But going on, I'd like to talk a little bit about one aspect of services from biodiversity, which I think has been vastly underplayed and underappreciated. There was no mention of knowledge services in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, but in the end, since every species represents a set of solutions to a unique set of biological problems, biodiversity collectively and the way it interacts in ecosystems and in larger formats is essentially a living library for the life sciences. So I'll just give you two examples of how this works. One is one of my favorites. It involves the bushmaster, a large poisonous snake from the South American rainforests for which people rarely have warm feelings, especially when you tell them that the venom of the bushmaster causes its victim's blood pressure to go to zero forever. Scientists at Brazil's famous Butantan Institute some decades back, studying how this venom worked, discovered a whole new system of regulation of blood pressure, the angiotensin system. And while snake venom itself cannot be used as a medicine, knowing that the system existed, pharmaceutical chemists were able to build molecules that play with that system. And that was the origin of the ACE inhibitors, which literally lead to tens of millions of people living longer, healthier, and more productive lives all around the world. Or consider this hot spring in Yellowstone, set aside for its scenic beauty. In 1993, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was given to a laid-back Californian named Kerry Mueller for conceiving of the polymerase chain reaction, a reaction that allows one to multiply genetic material thousands of times over in the space of minutes and hours. At the time of this conception, there was no known enzyme resistant to heat, which would be critical to making that chain reaction work. So there was a reaction, but not a chain reaction. And somebody was just smart enough to say, surely somewhere in nature, there are organisms that exist at very high temperatures that might have a heat-resistant enzyme that could make this work. And they went to the American Type Culture Collection, sort of a national zoo for microbes in the state of Maryland, and indeed, Thomas Brock, a microbiologist, had deposited a bacterium from the Yellowstone hot springs known as Thermus aquaticus, and it had, in fact, the enzyme that makes the polymerase chain reaction works. The average person reading PCR in the newspaper has no clue about that background. They may not even quite understand what it does. But basically, it has revolutionized diagnostic medicine, forensic medicine, provided the basis for the Human Genome Project. The benefits to humanity are enormous. So I'm just in passing make the point that we undervalue the living library for the life sciences and should be paying it more attention and giving it more publicity. Back sort of in the realm of knowledge services, but relating to the economy, there are two ways in which biological organisms grow. One, like the crocodile, eating more throughout its life, getting larger throughout its life, the kind of thing I struggle with on a daily basis. And then there is the way in which the organism does not grow larger, does not consume more, but becomes more complex. And I've had a wonderful ongoing conversation about this with Pavan Sukdev of the TEEB project, and quite logically he said to me, well, give me an example of the latter. And actually, I'd never stopped to think about an example, but I did, and I realized a caterpillar transforming into a butterfly is an example of complex growth involving no additional consumption other than the base maintenance. So we need to think about ways in which the economy can grow in complexity with minimizing consumption and actually having an economy like a butterfly. So the remainder of this talk will be on climate change and biodiversity, the implications for biodiversity if we don't address climate change, and then how biodiversity can make a major difference in how we approach it. So I've been studying this topic for 25 years. I've done two books. The first was in time for the Earth Summit, in which one basically sort of talked about what happened in the past and imagined how it might apply to the future. By the time the second one came out in 2005, we were already seeing definite signals of change in nature from climate change. So to put this into perspective, when Arrhenius asked in 1896 the very important question that led to the concept of the greenhouse effect, the question actually was, why is the Earth a habitable temperature for humans and other forms of life? Really, really important question. And the answer, of course, was the presence of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and he actually did an estimate of what doubling them would do to the Earth's temperature. But what he would not have known about is the detailed history of the climate of the planet in the previous 100,000 years or so, which involved a lot of abrupt climate change, as you can see, but most important included the last 10,000 years as an unusually stable period in the history of the climate. This is a really important piece of all of this that often gets left out in discussions. So in that 10,000 years, of course, it's all recorded human history, a certain amount of unrecorded human history, the origin of agriculture, the origin of human settlements, makes the point the entire human enterprise has been based on the assumption of a stable climate, and ecosystems have spent that same 10,000 years adjusting to a stable climate. And of course, now that's changing, about 3/4 degree warmer on average, and the emissions are going definitely in the wrong direction. So the question is, what kinds of signals are we already seeing in the natural world? Some of them revolve around the solid and liquid phases of water, and they're most prominent near the North Pole, and here you can see the expansion and contraction of ice on the Arctic Ocean from before 1980 to about 2007. And basically you can see that it is contracting at an accelerating rate faster than had been predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Lakes are freezing up later in the autumn, ice breaking up earlier in the spring, glaciers in retreat in most parts of the world. All tropical glaciers are retreating at a rate that they will be gone within 15 years. And of course, we're beginning to see sea level rise, at first because of the thermal expansion of water, but more recently because of the addition of glacial melt from the land. And we are seeing situations like the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge on the eastern shore of Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay in the United States, which is because of a combination of sea level rise and land subsidence, is well on its way to becoming a marine refuge. Still somewhat in question is the whole issue of increased frequency of more intense tropical cyclones, but I would say there is gathering evidence of more intense weather events of all sorts all around the world. There is no question about increased incidence of wildfire in the western United States or in Australia and undoubtedly some other parts of the world. And we are also beginning to see biological change. So lilacs blooming earlier in New England, whole series of plant species at the Royal Botanic Garden at Kew blooming earlier. It's not just plants, it's also animals. So bird species are migrating earlier, nesting earlier, laying eggs earlier. In the United States, we even have two species which have ceased to migrate. And more important, species have begun to change where they occur. So this butterfly is one of the two best-known species in North America. It clearly has been moving northward and upward in altitude. And the same kind of pattern has been detected with butterflies in Europe. And the change is such that in the United States, the National Arbor Day Foundation, which is hardly some wild-eyed environmental terrorist group, but just about people who like to plant trees, literally has found it necessary to produce a new hardiness zone map to guide tree growers as to which species they can hope to be successful with where they live. Nature is on the move in a way in which science has never recorded it almost anywhere you look in the world. And it's not just on the land, it's also in the ocean. So plankton distributions have been changing, fish distributions have been changing. In the Chesapeake Bay, the eelgrass communities turn out to have eelgrass as a very temperature-sensitive plant, a strict upper limit of temperature. So the southern boundary of the eelgrass communities have been moving steadily northward year after year. And it's not just in the temperate zone that we're seeing these changes. We're seeing them in the tropics as well. So in the legendary cloud forest of Monteverde, what we're seeing, in fact, is a change in the altitude at which clouds form on average, which means an increasing number of dry days for an ecosystem that essentially depends entirely on condensation from clouds as its source of moisture. In the oceans, the equivalent of tropical cloud forests and rainforests, the tropical coral reefs, all look like this when I was in graduate school. Wonderful, technicolor, highly productive, highly diverse communities on which 5% of humanity depends because they live within 100 meters of coral reefs. Starting in 1983, increased temperatures began to stress coral reefs, and what happens is the basic partnership on which the entire system depends between a coral animal and an alga breaks down, and the coral animal expels the alga, and the entire technicolor world goes black and white. The diversity crashes, the productivity crashes in what are known as bleaching events, occurring with greater frequency every year. And of course, there are a whole number of species that depend on ice for their natural history. The polar bear is the icon for all of those, but it is not the only one. So far, these are only really minor little ripples in the natural world. The real question is, what does it look like looking ahead? So the first estimate, as many of you know, was this paper in Nature in January 2004, referred to already this morning, projecting something on the order of 30% of all species driven to extinction or committed to extinction if we double pre-industrial greenhouse gas level concentrations in the atmosphere. And that will, of course, affect temperature around the globe, but importantly, it will also affect moisture. And the point to be made here is the two most important physical factors for any terrestrial organism are temperature and moisture. Both of those will be changing. In the prairie pothole region of the American Middle West, we're already seeing a drying trend, and we're beginning to see what are known as decoupling events, where tightly timed arrangements between two species break down because one depends on temperature and the other depends on day length. And so today it is quite possible early in the spring, when it used to not be anything other than snow-covered land, you see brilliant white snowshoe hares in their winter pelage, very conspicuous on greenish brown snowless landscapes. Or to give an Arctic example, the black guillemot, a nesting seabird, nests on land, flies to the edge of the ice to feed on Arctic cod, and each year that has been a longer distance for the particular colony on which this study is based, and finally it became too great a distance and the colony failed. In North America, we can look at particular species, iconic ones like the sugar maple, and what all the computer models show is that with double pre-industrial levels of CO2, the lovers of autumn foliage and maple sugar and maple syrup will have to go to Canada. Sounds like sort of trivial in one sense, but this really strikes at the identity of New Englanders and probably woke them up more than anything else. Fresh waters will change, so cold water species like trout will occur in different places. Those living on high places like the American pika, a rabbit relative in a number of spots in the American Rockies, will move upward but ultimately have no further upward to go and will wink out. It's being considered as an endangered species by the Department of Interior for that reason. And here is an example of this kind of thing for vertebrate endemic species in the rainforests. Anyway, I think you get the point that the warmer it is, the fewer the species survive. So coastal species will be vulnerable to sea level rise. Some will deal with it, some will not. But those on low-lying islands like the Key Deer and the Florida Keys will ultimately have nowhere else to go. So high-altitude species and island species as a class, particularly low-lying islands, are amongst the most endangered in the early phases of climate change. And we can expect that there will be increased frequency of bleaching events for tropical coral reefs. Really difficult to have a sanguine outlook for the future of tropical coral reefs. In addition, there are a whole series of complications if climate change progresses a great deal further. One is, of course, climate change isn't new in the history of life on Earth. Species came and went. North America and Europe, with the advance and retreat of the glaciers, not much biodiversity seems to have been lost at all. But the big difference today is that the landscapes have been converted basically into obstacle courses. So that as species would attempt to track their required conditions, they're likely to run into inhospitable habitat. As the former director of the National Zoo used to say, you know, that species would move, but Philadelphia is in the way. This one is pretty simple to think about a policy response to. Just put more connections back in the landscape. The rest, which I will describe of the complications, are much harder to find policy responses to other than to limit climate change so you don't get there. And one is, we know from studies of the way species responded in the past that it's the individual species that move, not the biological communities or the ecosystems. So each moves in its own direction and its own speed. And so ultimately what will happen is the ecosystems we know will disassemble and the surviving species will reassemble into new ecosystems which are hard to envision. And what you're looking at here are the dispersal patterns after the retreat of the last glacier in Europe for three mammals, two tree species, and an insect. And you can see there really isn't any pattern in common. We also know that change will not be linear or gradual. That could be with respect to the climate system itself, with some major feature like the global conveyor belt, but we're actually already seeing abrupt change in ecosystems. And one of these, and I now come to think of it as a form of ecosystem failure, involves the coniferous forests in North America. And here you're going to see the history of pine beetle outbreaks in British Columbia from the early 1960s until about 2002 or something like that. And what you can see at the beginning are only the tiniest little pinpricks of outbreaks. But as time goes on, and the winters are milder, more beetles overwinter, and as the summer is longer and the beetles actually get in an additional generation, they tip the balance. And so, ultimately, you have millions of acres in North America already with most of the coniferous trees dead. The U.S. projection, which I was recently told is an under projection, was going to be about 22 million acres. It's a major fire hazard, a major timber hazard. It's hard to imagine what the future of those forests are going to be like. And we are seeing major system change. This is a presentation of how moisture is generated and moves around the world, produced by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And basically, you see the vast majority of moisture is generated over the oceans and around the equator. And one of the great exceptions to that is the Amazon itself, where there is a remarkable system in which the Amazon literally has its own hydrological cycle and generates at least half of its own rainfall. And you will also notice that when it gets to the Andes, that high wall blocks it, and the consequence is some rain feeding into the Amazon River system, but moisture going north and south, even as far as northern Argentina. In 2004, that system broke down, or 2005, and there was the greatest recorded drought in the history of the Amazon. It fitted very nicely the Hadley Center's model, which shows the possibility of Amazon dieback. So what we're playing with here is working up to a point where climate change could trigger what is known as Amazon dieback in the southeastern and southern Amazon, where basically there would be insufficient rainfall and the vegetation would convert ultimately to cerrado after a lot of fire and human misery, loss of biodiversity, and loss of carbon to the atmosphere. Just on Friday, the World Bank finally released a study looking at all of that in the way it really needed to be looked at, which is putting climate change and deforestation and fire together. And the tipping point that comes out of that study is a 20% deforestation. Current deforestation is like at 18%. So it's very close to a tipping point there, but you can build the margin of safety back by active reforestation. But it does give you a sense of how close we are to some major changes in the global system that can affect biodiversity. And of course, the largest system change of all has been referred to already, namely the acidification of the oceans. 30% more acid, affecting the ability of tens of thousands of species to build their shells and skeletons. And some of them we know the names of, most of them few people do, but they exist in countless numbers at the base of food chains, like these little pteropods. And there are already signs of effects at the base of the food chains in the North Atlantic and off of Alaska. So it is a profound change, and one that almost all the geoengineering schemes don't even touch. This will give you a sense of what this could all mean. 280 parts per million, of course, at the pre-industrial level. And without going into a lot more, there are signs of positive feedbacks in other parts of the world from the thawing of the tundra. And basically, we're playing with critical thresholds in the Earth system. We know they exist. We don't know a lot about them. We don't know how they work. It's clearly a place where we don't want to go. So the question is, where should we stop? And if you begin to really look at it through biological eyes, you come quickly to the conclusion that 450 parts per million or 2 degrees is too much for global ecosystems. Already have ecosystem failure with the coral reefs and the coniferous forests of North America, the Amazon close to a tipping point. These are places that it makes no sense to go. Many of us have now sort of come to the conclusion that we should not go beyond 350 parts per million, which is below 2 degrees. Problem, of course, is we're already around 390. So what to do about all of this? And one set of things, obviously, is to adapt conservation strategies to make ecosystems more resistant to the changes they're going to experience, such as increasing connections in the landscape, minimizing other impacts. And we are going to hear people saying, well, why did you put all that money into all those man and biosphere reserves when most of them are not going to be able to protect the species they were set up to protect? The answer is the existing protected areas are the safe havens from which new biogeographic pattern can emerge. And we need not less conservation, we need more conservation. So there's obviously a huge energy agenda, which I won't go into here. There is the portion of emissions that comes from the destruction of ecosystems, the whole issue around tropical forests, which has been so much part of the discussion and negotiation in recent years. And basically, we're playing with this following equation, that every year, something on the order of 9 billion tons of CO2 goes in the atmosphere, the biggest portion from fossil fuels, and a big chunk ending up in the atmosphere, the land absorbing some, and the oceans absorbing some. So the big problem is the long residence times greenhouse gases have in the atmosphere, and the question then becomes, are there ways to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and get it down to a level which is less dangerous for ecosystems and other consequences of climate change? And twice in the history of life on Earth, for geological reasons, there have been enormously high CO2 levels, then brought down to levels close to pre-industrial. First time that occurred was with the origin of plants on land and the spreading of vegetation, taking all that CO2 out of the atmosphere, building up soil, removing more CO2 out of the atmosphere and soil formation. Second time was with the expansion of modern flowering plants, doing all of that more efficiently. So that says there is some promise in biological systems to help us address all of this. And to put it into context, in the last three centuries, something on the order of a couple hundred billion tons of carbon have gone into the atmosphere from the way we have treated ecosystems. Not just deforestation, but degrading grasslands, the way we practice agriculture. I think where biodiversity can actually revolutionize the way we think about addressing climate change is one, in terms of how much climate change is acceptable, and in helping us think about ways to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. So I've become a wild proponent of a major planetary scale restoration of ecosystems as a way to simultaneously pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and make all the ecosystems more resilient in the face of climate and other stresses we're putting upon them. I think there might be about 150 billion tons of carbon that you could take out that way. That probably is a smaller number than might be the case if we did some things differently, but our numbers are large and we need the land for lots of things. But it is equivalent to the difference between 390 parts per million in the atmosphere where we are today and 350, the so-called safe level. So there is a major role for forests here, which is not new to anybody in this room, a major role for grasslands and restoring grazing lands, a major role in transforming agriculture to build up soil carbon, of which an awful lot has been lost over the last couple centuries. And the economics of ecosystems and biodiversity projects has done some really interesting calculations about what this might mean in terms of return. And there are rates of return on that chart, which you probably can't see, that would make any investment banker very eager to engage. So where I come to is looking at biodiversity and climate change is saying biodiversity has to revolutionize how we look at climate change, how much we allow to happen, and how we address it. And it is, in the end, a transformation of how we view ourselves on this planet. And you can't get there without going beyond slowing the rates of extinction, without going beyond stopping to restoring the biosphere to its proper operating condition, and recognizing in the end this planet does not work just as a physical system, but as a physical system and a biological system, very closely interlinked. And so I'm suggesting regreening the Emerald Planet. There are ocean agendas here too that can contribute, and making the living planet more habitable by restoring the planet. Thank you.
That was Thomas Lovejoy addressing a UNESCO conference in Paris, January 25, 2010. The recording is from Stephen Leahy, one of the few independent environmental journalists left to us. Keep Stephen working for the world. Donate to cover his expenses at StephenLeahy.net. That's Stephen with a P-H, L-E-A-H-Y.net. We can expect a lot more international coverage from Stephen. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Don't give up yet. Save it for next week when we go diving into the bleak. Broadcast on 20 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.